Hello, everybody, and welcome to another really beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show for you today. My guest will be Michael Varaka. He is the assistant professor and chairman of the Department of Urban Horticulture and Design at Farmingdale State College. And I'm inviting him on to talk to us about his sustainable garden that they have founded there at the college, and talk to us about some events he has coming up and what they're doing to change the landscape of aquaculture here on Long Island. And I also have a recipe to share with you and share with you a lot of upcoming events. But as always, I want to talk to everybody about this movement I am really trying to foster. And this is a movement for everybody, vegetarian, omnivore, carnivore, whatever it is you eat. When you go out to eat, since we all do that so often, ask the waiter where the entree is being sourced from, whether you're eating meat or vegetables or fish. Ask them, is this fish wild? Is it sustainably raised? You know, question about the fish. Question about the meat. Where is it sourced? Is it antibiotic-free? Is it hormone-free? And same with the vegetables. Ask if they come locally. Are they organic? As we ask these questions, we create a buzz. We create an awareness for restaurateurs to know that the public is changing, that we are starting to really care where our food comes from, and we want to make a difference in our world and in our own lives and in our diets. And we do that by voting with our forks, basically. That's not going to be enough, but it is a start. And if we do that and we start creating a demand for more hormone-free and antibiotic-free meats and poultry and wild fish, restaurants will start adjusting. And it's already happening. You already see it happening. But we need to bring it into the mainstream. And we really need to press for that. And I've had great success when I've asked about it. And I do try to make my choices based on the information that I get back. But if you're at a restaurant where they don't have anything wild, they don't have anything sustainably raised, anything organic, and you're bound to stay there, you can just say, okay, well, I'm disappointed, but I'll get this anyway. And, you know, or you can choose to leave and go to another restaurant. But whichever your choice is, just that act of questioning raises the awareness. And I had a great conversation with a farmer recently, food service manager at a school, who was saying that they were really trying to bring more antibiotic-free, hormone-free meats into the schools, but basically in one day they bought up all of the sustainable chicken that was available in that state. And so, you know, there is right now the production of the kind of foods that we want to eat are not being produced on a large enough scale for us to satisfy all of the demand. And that's what we need to create. We need to create a big enough demand so that more and more farmers and producers start transitioning back over to natural and organic methods, because they're starting to see that that's what people want. And in that mode, we also need to push for the labeling of GMOs. I know, you know, most of my listeners, I'm preaching somewhat to the choir, but genetically modified organisms are in everything. And I'd say, well, I should say 90% of all the processed foods in the supermarket contain some form of genetically modified ingredient. And we have a right to know, and so there's a big push for labeling GMO products here in New York. And New York's really important because there's other states that are dependent on our policies. Connecticut voted to label GMOs, but it's contingent on New York State passing a similar law. Same goes for Rhode Island, Maine. So we really need to make this whole New England area GMO not, I wish it was GMO free, but at least GMO labeling. And, you know, that's the first step. Then we'll work towards the GMO free. So if everybody can really do that, that would be most helpful. Of course, I always have petitions that you can sign on my website, and one of them is for Tom Vilsack, the USDA Secretary of Agriculture, a petition to send to him that we do not want the weakening of the organic standards. Right now, the National Organic Standard Board, which decides what non-organic materials are allowed in organic foods, they are being pushed to weaken those regulations and allow more and more non-organic products into our organic. Or for that matter, let's say we're getting organic tomatoes and they happen to not be available that week, they can still label them organic tomatoes and put in non-organic tomatoes. And that's just not okay. So we need to let our voices be heard. Please sign the petition. There's also a petition for New Yorkers against fracking. There's also a petition for the Keystone XL pipeline. As you know, a couple summers ago, I went down to Washington and stood in line in an act of civil disobedience and protested the Keystone pipeline. Well, this is still a big issue. Obama has yet to approve it, but they have approved one section of it, actually, from Canada to, I'm not sure how far down, but we need to really step up and let President Obama know that we do not want this Keystone pipeline. We see in the news constantly how these pipelines are leaking. They are not secure. They leak. And we need to really invest in more renewable fuels and renewable sources. So we need to sign these petitions. We need to let our legislators know. And, you know, as much as it's nice to put our heads in the sand and pretend that everything's just peachy keen, we can't really do that because there's a lot of issues here that are at hand. This past week, I actually saw Wendell Berry and Wes Jackson at the Great Hall at Cooper Union. Mark Bittman was there as the moderator. And it was just a great, great discussion about agriculture in this country and the need for more and more people to wake up to the fact that this green revolution that we were sold really did not work. You know, this green revolution was sold to the farmers to go towards monocropping, to go to synthetic fertilizers, which use tremendous amounts of oil. And the whole package is one catastrophe after the next. You know, it's changed the soil. We've depleted the soil. The runoff from all these chemicals pollutes the water. You know, it's just a snowballing effect of bad decisions based on bad decisions. And what these two gentlemen were calling for was a return to what's working in nature and to mimic nature to find the solutions for bringing back our agriculture. And there actually are solutions, and we just need to help people transition to those solutions. And part of that is by creating this demand that I was talking about of when you go out. If they realize that there is such a demand for a more healthy, natural food system, people will start making those changes. Also because it's just not working for the farmer. They are not making any money in the system that's, you know, set up right now. And we need to train young people to go into agriculture, because otherwise if we don't have farmers, we will not have food. So it's all, you know, as always, everything's connected. And I just, you know, beg all of you to pay attention and to get involved and check out the issues. Yes, if you don't get my weekly newsletter, please sign up for it. You can do that at iegreen.com. Every week I talk about some of the things that are in the news, ways you can take action. This week in the news, you know, there was a study that was done recently that found the herbicide glyphosate. Glyphosate. Found in breast milk. And that's a, you know, it's a real target. It's not just an herbicide. It's also a pesticide. It's found in mother's breast milk. And, you know, for a long time we were told that these pesticides and herbicides don't transfer over into mother's breast milk, and this report shows that it absolutely does. So, you know, there's, like I said, there's always wonderful things. Also, the fracking issue is a really big one. Food and Water Watch is doing great work on raising awareness about fracking, but fracking is just a really bad method of extracting, you know, extracting gas from down mile deep into the shale rock, and in the process of doing that, they're devastating the landscapes. They're releasing methane into the environment. It's just, you know, the polluting water. I mean, again, it's just a bad, bad decision. And the only people it benefits are the companies that are making loads of profit. And so we really need to put a stop to that. So you'll find those petitions all on my website, so please check it out. And please get involved. That's all I can ask of everybody, because these issues are just, you know, here and present, and they're not going to go anywhere until we all make them go somewhere. Okay, lots of great things are coming up. It's such a difference. I mean, you can really feel spring is here, because all of a sudden all these events are coming up, almost too many for me to mention. But in the winter, I'm searching for events to share with all of you, and in the spring, I really have to negotiate which ones to share with you. But this weekend, as I will talk about later with my guest on the show, is a wonderful workshop at Farmingdale State College. It's called Waste Not, Want Not, and it's a sustainability garden educational field day, as well as a CSA fair. And for those of you that do not know what CSA is, it stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and it's a way to source locally farmed vegetables in your area and get them at a very sustainable price. And the way you do that is by purchasing a share up front at the beginning of the season. But I do want to say to everyone listening that if coming up with that that big bulk of money at the beginning of the season is a hardship for you, very often you can talk to the farmer, because they understand that, and if they can work with you, they will. But buying a share into a community-supported farm is a great way of getting local seasonal vegetables. You get them right there the day that they're harvested, and nothing could be better, and it also just brings the price down to something that everyone can afford. And another great thing is you actually get vegetables that you might not even have heard of before, or that you don't know what to do with. And very often the farmers will give, along with the vegetable, a recipe how to use it. And also know that you can always send me an email if you want to know what to do with something. I can help you there. So my email is bhavani@iegreen.com, and please feel free to ask me. So that's this weekend, April 12th. April 21st, there's an Earth Day celebration that Slow Food Huntington is helping to sponsor, along with Food and Water Watch, at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. We're going to be screening the film Gasland 2, which is more about the fracking issue and a continuation of the original film Gasland. Really great. If you're available, that is April 21st, Monday evening, at 7:30. Also, April 23rd is a great organization, Citizens Climate Lobby, which is an organization that is really pushing for carbon tax credits, for people doing the right thing, and trying to encourage businesses to either reduce their carbon inputs, you know, and to put this carbon tax, make it viable so that people can have incentives to lower their climate effect. So that's a really great thing. And they've always been all the way out east, and I've never been able to go to their meetings. But now there is a new chapter that just formed in Queens. So this one is going to take place April 23rd from 6 to 9:30 at Panera Bread in Bayside. So you can go to the Citizen Climate Lobby website to find out more information about that. April 26th and 27th is the New York City Green Festival. That takes place at Pier 94. That's a great, great event. You know, you can come down and not only see some of the latest products, but you also, there's lectures going on all day, you know, from food to fashion, health, energy, construction and design. There's both vegan and vegetarian cooking demos, educational activities for kids and families, speakers, music, lots of stuff. So over 300 eco-friendly businesses will be on display, so check that out. May 10th, there's a River Keeper Sweep, and that's the third annual day of service for the Hudson River Estuary, an opportunity to help clean up the Hudson River. So you can find out more information about that on my website. May 10th, there's also a spring planting day at Catskey Farm. They're part of the Sylvia Center in New York. I've had them as guests on my radio show. It's a great organization teaching kids about farming, and they're having an open spring planting day on May 10th from 11 to 3 in Kinderhook, New York. Edible communities are having great events coming up. A big one is at the New School. It's the Edible Communities Institute. It's called Edible Institute 2014. That's at the New School May 10th and 11th, and there's loads of discussions on that, more than I can actually mention on air, so go to the Edible Institute website. May 13th, Michael Pollan is going to be speaking at the 92nd Street Y. There are still tickets if you want to get those. And then more and more, but as I said, go to my website if you want to hear them all, because right now I want to share with you my recipe so that I can then invite on my guest. So this week I'm just doing a very simple recipe that was inspired because I actually was hired by Suffolk County Food Policy. Well, actually, it's not Suffolk County. I've been working with the Suffolk County Food Policy Council, and there's actually a link on my website to their new Facebook page. But through that, there's a new piece of legislation that's being proposed that is going to require Suffolk County public beaches and office buildings to offer food on menus that are 700 calories and less. And so we have been meeting with some of the Suffolk County beaches to encourage them to have more offerings on their menus that are healthier and less calories. And so trying to switch out the regular French fries, which seem to come with every fried basket that they offer at the beaches, I introduced these crispy sweet potato fries. And, of course, they're not really fried. They're baked in the oven. So I just wanted to share those with you. And, you know, I bake sweet potatoes all the time, and I love them, but they're not crispy. And that's okay with me. I mean, I just, you know, I cut them up, put olive oil on them. But they felt for the beach purpose, the kids and people are really looking for crispy sweet potato fries. And I found the only way to really get them crispy is to actually dredge them in some cornstarch. So I want to just start off by saying that if you're going to use cornstarch, do make sure you're getting organic cornstarch. Otherwise, it will be a genetically modified product. So this is what you need are just three sweet potatoes cut into long fry shape. The thinner you cut them, the crispier they will be. A quarter cup of olive oil, 3 tablespoons of cornstarch, and salt to taste, paprika to sprinkle on top. If you want to put pepper on, that's optional. And so you're going to dredge the sweet potatoes in the cornstarch by placing the cornstarch in a large Ziploc bag, adding the sweet potatoes and just shaking the bag around. And then as you pull them out, kind of shake the sweet potatoes in your hand so you get as much of the cornstarch off as possible. And then you're going to spread them out on a lined cookie sheet that you've, you know, put down parchment paper and you've covered with some olive oil. And you lay the sweet potatoes out, and then you just toss them in the oil that's already on the pan. Sprinkle it with salt and pepper and bake in a preheated 450-degree oven. So it's a hot oven for about 15 to 20 minutes, and that depends on how thin you've cut the fries. And just let them go until they're crispy. Halfway through, if you want to turn them over, you can certainly do that, and that will help crispen the side that's facing down. Will get crispy. And that's it. So enjoy those. Give me feedback. I'd love to hear from everybody. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Michael Varaca. He is, as I said, the assistant professor and chairman of the Department of Urban Horticulture and Design at Farmingdale State College in New York, Long Island. And along with his students, In 2011, he designed a half-acre sustainable garden on the campus grounds. Now in its second year of construction, actually I guess it's third year now, the garden's major components will demonstrate sustainable landscape design and horticulture principles that promote environmental stewardship through the development of a landscape that demonstrates responsible resource use, using the production of local food, energy, and products. A former organic farmer from New England, Michael is a founding member of the Rhode Island chapter of NOFA and served as the first certified organic farm inspector for the state of Rhode Island. Baraka lectures frequently throughout the Northeast on a variety of horticulture and landscape design subject areas and land use topics. Michael, are you with me?
I am, Bhavani, and thank you for in having me on this morning.
Oh, you're so welcome. I'm really thrilled to have you here. I'm really looking forward to this event coming up this weekend. But before I have you go into this event and what it's all about, can you share with us what's behind your department, the Department of Urban Horticulture and Design?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. I know that most Long Islanders who are aware of horticulture or gardens, public gardens, and sort of the natural beauty of Long Island have long known about Farmingdale State College. We've had a lot of names over the years. We were originally an ag and tech school, and we celebrated the centennial of the college in 2012. And we are part of the SUNY system, which is the State University of New York. And Farmingdale is probably known to most people over the age of 40 as SUNY Farmingdale, but each of the SUNY schools now is branding themselves sort of as an individual school. And we have been known now for about 7 or 8 years as Farmingdale State College. But we have long had a horticulture program here on the campus, actually dating since the origin of the school in 1912. And for many years, there was both agriculture and horticulture here. And the distinction very early on was to call non-food-producing growing ornamental horticulture. And we were known as an ornamental horticulture program up until about a month or so ago, when after about a two-year study, we were looking at sort of educational trends and, frankly, seeing a bit of stagnation in interest in our program. We did a lot of research, and we decided that what we would like to do, and now that we have actually changed over, call our department the Department of Urban Horticulture and Design. And really the reason behind that now is you know, Long Islanders, although they may not want to admit it, we, from a land use point of view, I think Long Island, because it's very densely populated, now best viewed as an extension of the New York City area, which means that we have some of the same challenges but opportunities that are endemic to urban landscapes. You know, the idea that you talked about earlier today and very often have talked about, and that is reconnecting people with open space, and particularly open space areas that are flexible enough to be used for many things, including urban food or just, you know, food production in general. The kind of concept of making people, you know, more interactive with parks, and whether it's in their little village or town or city, and we're quite aware that the whole region, if not the entire planet now, is faced with, you know, environmental degradation, you know, the idea that resources are limited, and our environment is very complex right now. So we're very interested in working with other organizations, but particularly educating our students or would-be students about how they can improve their lives but also the lives of the local region by understanding that environmental issues can best be dealt with on a holistic point of view. So, yes, we're still very interested in the aesthetics of landscapes, but we're very interested in sort of the environmental and underpinning issues that face all of us here on Long Island. So that's really, you know, why we've changed our name, and we're hopeful that more people now will understand and be interested in wanting to study horticulture here at Farmingdale.
Mm-hmm. Well, for like you said, for I think it was over 75 years, you had an agricultural program, and of course, you know, being a farmer went really out of fad, you know, many years ago, and people weren't interested. But now, with the sustainable food movement being so popular, and this whole trend towards not just growing food but cooking food and quality food, and raise, you know, the awareness of our current broken food system, has your school thought about bringing back some of the agricultural training? Because, like I said, I'm, you know, part of the Suffolk County Food Policy Council, and we were really talking about there's not really a good training program right now for farmers here on Long Island, and we have, you know, the median age of most farmers is, you know, over 55, and if we don't train new young people who are interested in farming in a sustainable way, so that it is sustainable, so that they can find a, you know, a market for their products. You know, farming, you know, all that open land that we do treasure out east will get developed.
Well, we absolutely have thought about it, Bhavani, and you know, I think what you mentioned at the onset there is very true. The previous administration of SUNY Farmingdale, you know, given the context of the times, saw the sort of transition of Long Island's open space and farm fields, you know, in the 70s and 80s, heading towards more technological, what I would call sort of suburban, you know, growth patterns,
mm-hmm.
and felt that, well, you know, farming isn't sophisticated. It doesn't represent sort of the educational mission of, at the time, where colleges wanted to go. So, unfortunately, they did shutter down the agricultural program. But I think you're absolutely right now. There is there's a huge hole here in the Northeast in general, but particularly in areas like Long Island, where land is very expensive, and the average person who is young and interested in wanting to learn how to farm, not only is it difficult to develop the skills, but it's nearly impossible to get access to land. So, here in the horticulture program, and that's really the purpose behind our one-half-acre sustainable garden, we're trying to show a new model and train students, but also interested, you know, regular citizens to come here, see what we're doing, take advantage of workshops. You know, they could be a couple of hour workshops to mini courses to actually enrolling in a semester-long course where we can begin to discover and explore techniques for actually learning how to grow. So we would love to be a part of all this, and you know, the most recent Long Island Small Summits that I know you were a part of, I think showed that many Long Islanders are hungry to learn how to grow a portion of their own food, or to make a partial or maybe full living out of growing food for market. And mm-hmm. you know, there are many people, as you've mentioned, who want to support the farmers who are already doing it. So we, you know, we are hopeful that as our new name implies, we are working very feverishly on changing the curriculum within our program so that we can actually offer semester-long courses in urban food production, in mm-hmm. permaculture, in water harvesting, and you know, soil building techniques, which would certainly apply to the urban or to the edible food side, but also just applies to the whole environmental awareness that is equally important here on Long Island, and that is to develop safe gardening techniques and strategies to implement in anybody's home, since we have so many suburban plots. So we're working, you know, sort of first off showing a new model, and that's the purpose behind the sustainable garden, to show that, yes, you can introduce a portion of food or edible plantings within a residential setting, and then secondly, to further extend that out and show that even on a small scale level, you can actually produce quite a bit of food. So, for instance, we've planted a very small orchard with 14 fruit trees that are hopefully in 2 or 3 years will begin to bear some fruit, and we've placed them in a small area to demonstrate that that could be something that you could put into your own yard. And, of course, then we are using herbs and edible flowers and vegetables and small fruits in ways that are ornamental and could be placed in a normal landscape, quote-unquote, but also could be utilized in more of a farm field setting. So I think there's a lot of hope. I think this is the future of education right now, is to sort of be an elixir, if you will, to combine one's lifestyle with environmental issues, with the local economy. And I think we're poised here at Farmingdale to really make an impact on that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know,
well, that's why I love food so much, because it does connect everything. And I say that all the time, but, you know, between you know, the environment and our health and the local economy, I mean, it all comes together, and it can all be, you know, looked at through the lens of food and food production, and, you know, it just touches on everything that I feel is important. So
I so agree with you, Bhavani. I think, you know, the whole focus on local foods right now is tremendous. This idea that people want to eat fresh food that's healthily grown, and I think it's here to stay. You know, somebody asked me the other day, do I think this is a fad now? You know, and when I was farming in the 1980s in New England, you know, this was before CSAs had really taken hold and before all these wonderful farmers markets were around, and it was much more difficult to convince people that, you know, supporting a local farmer or wanting to cook with seasonal foods was something that, you know, was a good thing to do. Of course, lots of people never stopped doing that, but I think now what I find exciting is both the average person and young people now are just so excited about this idea of eating locally, you know, and and the restaurant trade has really picked up on it, and the awareness that people have now that if you can support your local farmer, you can keep open space open and eat healthier and don't consume pesticides. And
well, that's one thing, though, that's always, you know, that's a little of a conundrum, is that, you know, you want to eat local, but I also want to eat organic. And so we have to also encourage the local farmers that are not yet, that have not yet transitioned to a sustainable model, to a antibiotic-free, pesticide, herbicide, hormone-free type of model.
Right.
That's what people want. When people say local, you know, that's really what people are wanting. They want local, but they want it to be raised sustainably so that they're not ingesting all these pesticides.
I agree, and I think, you know, as the average consumer learns more about where food comes from and how it's produced on a national or even international basis, they educate themselves, and farmers, I think, are responding to the sort of larger awareness and desire for people to have organic produce. So I think it's coming. I think, you know, one cog turns the other one, and I think, you know, one of the interesting things about Long Island, which is both, you know, enlightening but also kind of scary, is that, you know, we have a very high breast cancer rate here, and a lot of that has been attributed to chemicals in the environment, not only chemicals, you know, beyond sort of our day-to-day living, but also you know, the application of fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides on our landscapes. And the laws are now changing. You know, New York State, in particular Suffolk County, has some of the most restrictive application laws for landscapers. So although many in the industry have dragged their feet about this, I think most everybody would now agree that these are good laws, and the rationale behind them is to have better management practices, and this will help all of us. And I think eventually farmers more and more are going to shift to towards organics because I think they realize that this is what the consumer wants, and I think they're going to realize that it's healthier for them and actually in the long run probably going to be cheaper too because, you know, all of these chemicals are fossil fuel based, and as we know, the expense of fossil fuels is not going down, it's going up. And I think, you know, consumers are helping to drive the change, and I think regulatory agencies are helping to drive the change. And I think a lot of farmers know that if they grow organically, they can get a higher price for their crop.
Yeah, you're so right. And, you know, and it is so much about educating and learning, you know, and also knowing that you have the resource of the Internet now, and you have to really look at where your information is coming from. And I always say follow the money because, you know, we're sold things dishonestly from our government. I mean, it's, you know,
there's a lot of greenwashing out there.
Oh, yeah. Like when you hear about, you know, ethanol is going to be a more renewable energy or, you know, better energy, you know, people don't realize the amount of oil for the fossil fuel that's used to create the fertilizer that they use to grow that ethanol, so that the net profit is so little or net gain is so little anyway that it's, you know, it's just not what the picture that they try to paint for us. And
I think young people are now beginning to really become aware of this. And I think that, you know, I'm in my mid-50s, and I grew up in the 70s, sort of right after the original Earth Day. And, you know, the people that were my original heroes, like Rachel Carson and Aldo Leopold and Ian McCarg and, you know, Elliot Coleman and John Jevons and a lot of farmers who were trying to teach people to grow intensively and do it organically, as well as the environmentalists, everything that they were talking about has really become true. And, you know, there was sort of a half generation that might have missed all of that. But, yeah, I'm really hearkened today because a lot of young people, because, as you just said, the Internet is such a valuable tool, are very skeptical of the government. They're very skeptical of claims. They can do a lot of research. I mean, when I'm lecturing in a class and I mention a topic, there's half the class that already has a laptop in the class on, and they're already checking to see if what I'm saying is true. I mean, it's kind of daunting in some ways. But on the other hand, you know, this is the generation that we have today. They're very technologically savvy, and they can fact-check very quickly, and they can read between the lines, and they can see that, you know, on the one hand, we can be very myopic on Long Island. You know, we can think that this is the way it is everywhere. And on the other hand, I think there's an equal side that says, boy, it's a big world out there, and we need to extrapolate the best of what's going on elsewhere and bring it here. So I think there's a lot of hope amongst the young people today that we can make a change. And as an educator,
I agree with you. And I really want to talk about this upcoming event. But before we do, we're going to take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, I want to hear more about Waste Not, Want Not coming up this weekend. Everyone, you've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green. My guest today is Michael Varaka from the Department of Ornamental Horticulture. I'm sorry, Urban Horticulture and Design at Farmingdale State College. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Michael Varaka from the Department of Urban Horticulture and Design at Farmingdale State College. Michael, are you with me?
I am, Bhavani.
Great. So I really want to talk about your upcoming event this weekend, Waste Not, Want Not. Can you share with us what this event is about and what's going to be going on that day?
Sure. This is actually our fourth annual spring educational field day, and all of the proceeds that will hopefully be generated on Saturday will benefit the construction of our new sustainable garden that you alluded to earlier. And the field day is really designed to bring the public into the teaching gardens here at Farmingdale. and let them know what the department is doing. So first of all, I wanted to just let people know that this is held in conjunction with the college's open house program, which is going on for all of the programs on the campus. The college open house runs from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Well, we're offering a very extended program that's going to begin at 8:30, and it's going to continue until 4. It's held in our teaching garden domain and greenhouse complex, which is very easy to find off of Route 110 at the main entrance of the campus. And really what we're going to do is be talking about horticultural and agricultural issues and opportunities. So Waste Not, Want Not, the theme behind that really is that we need to do a better job as a society thinking about resources, whether they are repurposed materials or recycling, or whether we're going to be designing new gardens, environments, food systems, what have you. So I know it sounds somewhat lofty, but it's really not. It's really the premise behind it is to give people good information about how to improve their own lives and how to eat better, and also how to design better landscapes, whether they be home landscapes or actually edible landscapes of some sort. So we will have
it. Part of that day is the CSA fair?
Correct. So,
and is that taking place also in the gardens?
Yes, the two events are concurrently happening, although the CSA fair starts at 10 o'clock and runs until 2. So if you want to come to just to meet the farmers and find out more about CSAs, you don't have to pay an admission fee. The Waste Not, Want Not program does have a nominal admission fee of $10.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that runs from 8:30 until 4. The difference.
How many farmers do you have coming down?
We have about 15 farmers at this
point
who have signed up, and they're it's people have been asking, are they just Suffolk County farmers? And the answer is no. We do have Nassau County farmers coming as well. So it, no matter where you live on Long Island, I think you'll find that there'll be a farmer relatively close to you.
Well, I should say also, even if the farmer is from out east, many of them have drop-off points that are in Nassau
that's
County
correct.
Or in local
that's
areas. So
that's absolutely
just
correct.
Just the farmers from a little further away doesn't mean you have to schlep out to Suffolk County if you're in Nassau
that's
County.
That's absolutely correct. And if you don't know a whole lot about what a CSA is, there's a wonderful moment built into the program, which is going to be at 11:30. We're going to have a panel discussion of five farmers who will describe in their own business model how their CSA works. And so you can certainly come before that and after that and experience, you know, by talking with all the growers how they run their farm and what sorts of crops that they grow. But if you don't know anything about a CSA and you just want to learn more about it, the panel discussion at 11:30 to 12 I think will be very interesting, because you will hear comparisons and contrasting concepts of from the farmers' mouths themselves about how they run their business. And also I want to let people know that much in the spirit of what you do, Bhavani, we will be having a lunch available for people to purchase at a very nominal fee that features all Long Island-based foods. So it is a vegetarian lunch made of farm-produced products. We're also going to be serving, you know, our own local honey that we produce from hives here in our gardens. And everything that will be sold is Long Island-grown or produced. So it's a wonderful way to sort of experience, you know, farm-fresh eating if you haven't done that before. So that will be available from about 11:30 until 1. And it will be right next door to the CSA fair. So the main difference between the two events is that there are lectures in the Waste Not, Want Not that would be very interesting to people who want to learn a little bit more. The topics range from sort of how to collect water, you know, from your own home or structure and reutilize it or repurpose it, to how to garden or landscape in a more sustainable way without chemicals, and understanding what plants you might select and what strategies you might use. Everybody knows that we had a terrible storm here on Long Island called Hurricane Sandy, and a lot of lumber came down, trees were fallen, and we have a wonderful speaker who's going to talk about how people can actually take fallen timber, or when they in fact hire someone to cut a tree down, how that wood product might actually become something very usable, from furniture to a garden structure to something that has very useful qualities to it. So again, what we're trying to do with Waste Not, Want Not as a theme is to show that we can develop a local economy, and we can not only that, develop sort of a mechanism for being very purposeful and very careful about how we use our resources. So it's really going to be sort of like an old-fashioned farm fair. There will be plants for sale that the students have grown. There will be tools and books that will give you help and information about how to, you know, manage your own grounds. There'll be the nice local farm fresh food. And you can tour our teaching gardens. You can see the sustainable garden and learn more about what we're trying to do.
Sounds like a great day. I know I'll be there. So I encourage everyone to come. And, you know, it's also wonderful to, if you are from this area, just to meet your local community, you know, and to build on building community amongst people that care about our environment and the foods we eat. And, you know, after the Small Farm Summit, I really realized we have a very strong community here. We're just so spread out. There's not enough opportunities for us all to come together and feel like a real force.
Yeah, I think that's really true.
So uplifting about the Small Farm Summit. So,
without a doubt. And I know at the beginning of your program you were talking about how there are so many events and it's hard to stay on top of them. And I can really relate to that. I wish I could get out into meeting more and more people. But this is an opportunity for people to come and see how educational institutions today are really trying hard to embrace multi-pronged initiatives. And we would love to see as many people as possible come out, and we can promise you a really good day.
Great. Now, I have a question I wanted to ask. I don't know if you, I'm sure you can answer it. When I went and heard Wes Jackson and Wendell Berry last week speak, one thing Wes Jackson talked about was how the Land Institute is really working on perennializing the major crops so that their roots can really hold the soil in place, because that's so much what they're talking about, of the degradation of soil and the runoff of soil and how much soil we're losing on an annual basis. What does perennializing major crops mean? Like, how does that work?
Well, first of all, I wish I knew about that talk. That's a good example of how I can't possibly have known what everything that's going on. But I had the privilege, as an aside, to go to the Land Institute in 1984 and meet Wes Jackson. And he said something to me at that point that has stuck in my mind ever since, and that's 30 years ago, and that is that the way we're going to solve society's problems is to have more eyes per acre working on them. And what he meant by that was, you know, we need what is sort of happening today, the idea that more people are interested in growing and caring for the land. So that's always stuck with me. But what Wes has been working on for a very long time, because he's really a geneticist, but in a positive way, is to kind of cross, annual production crops with perennially based plants. And the wonderful thing about perennials is you plant them once, and you don't have to turn the soil over, and you don't have to disturb the soil life and open the soil up to erosion. So he's absolutely right. I mean, perennially, we do have perennially based food crops now. I mean, one example.
Asparagus.
I'm sorry?
Asparagus.
Yeah, asparagus is a wonderful example. You know, many herbs, of course, are perennially based. You know, one on Long Island, of course, we have a huge viticulture industry, so there's another one. Any sort of fruit production is another example, and it can go on and on and on. So the idea of developing or hybridizing edible plants to become perennially based, I think, is very exciting. And the premise of permaculture is really based upon that as well, this idea of permanent agriculture. So, Ruth Stout, who 40 years ago was talking about no-till growing, the premise can be applied, even in our current food system, where you minimize turning the soil over And if you have to, that you immediately mulch afterwards so that you're not exposing bare soil to wind erosion or waterborne erosion. And it's a very good, you know, sustainable, long-standing practice. And we try to practice that again in the sustainable garden. We have developed a rudimentary but ever-improving composting system. And we're strong proponents of using organic mulches that you could maybe even grow yourself. I mean, the idea of a cover crop that farmers have been using for eons is a wonderful example of that, to grow a crop like clover that you could place around, you know, we'll use a sort of, you know, larger example of corn being grown on an acreage basis, you know. Once the corn is germinating, or at the same time as you sow the corn, you can sow a cover crop or use a different plowing method where you're not exposing all of the soils to being turned over. And homeowners can do this as well.
So kind of a companion plant?
Exactly.
A cover crop along with the crop you're looking to harvest.
Exactly. You know, and there are many, many, and many farmers do this already. You know, I think of, for example, a good example is Fox Hollow Farm over in Huntington or Dix Hills, right on the border there. Larry and Heather, who run that wonderful little farm, have shown me some wonderful examples of very simple strategies for using cover crops in a what could really be construed as a garden sort of scale. So these are the kind of techniques that you can learn from your local CSA grower if you buy a share and develop a relationship with them. And they're also the kind of things that we can teach you here at Farmingdale. So it's great to hear that Wes Jackson was talking about that, but I think all of us can practice what we would call sound soil husbandry techniques right in our own yard.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Are you getting a lot of interest from young students? You know, what is their thinking in
Well, we're getting a larger interest. It's interesting, you know, I teach a seminar class each semester where we talk about contemporary horticultural and land use issues. And I do think that the majority of the students who come into the program here are historically based around the suburban, you know, lawn and foundation planting concept
mm-hmm.
of what
right.
horticulture is. And some of them are reticent to want to change that concept because they're afraid they won't be able to make a living because the average Long Islander is still holding on to that paradigm. But more and more what I'm seeing, both from students and also from people who come to our events here, is that they see this shift and they want to learn more about, you know, what could I do to replace my water-intensive and chemically hooked lawn? Could I do something else? Could I put in a meadow or a habitat garden that attracts butterflies and birds? And
mm-hmm.
could I could I grow something in my front yard that might be edible?
Well, I remember when Jill Salatin was our keynote speaker at the first Farm Summit. You know, he talked about growing fruit everywhere. Could you imagine
right.
along the side of the highways, you know, there were fruit trees and, you know, instead of all these ornamentals that don't produce, if we were planting food that could produce so that people could just stop along the road, you're hungry? Pick it
yeah.
up. You know, it would be lovely.
Exactly.
You know, even when I've traveled to some of the islands, you know, and, you know, there's a lot of very poor people, they're not hungry because there's food
no.
being grown everywhere.
Exactly.
And it's a very different, you know, landscape.
Yep, you know, I think it's somewhat ironic that on Long Island, which has the economic means to do a lot of different things, that in many ways we're behind the curve here because other cultures, other parts of the country, are much further along with some of these
yeah.
issues.
Well, I don't want to cut you off, but I think we're just about out of time. So I just want to thank you and say that, you know, the work you're doing there at Farmingdale is really, really making an impact and helping to change that landscape so that Long Island doesn't stay behind the curve. So thank you, Michael, for your work.
And thanks for having me on. And everybody, please come out on Saturday.
You're welcome. And everyone, please do come out on Saturday, and thank you for listening. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. See you again next Thursday. Bye for now. Yeah.